Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges.
Good afternoon. This is Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, bringing you and hosting the Blog Talk Radio of the Reasonable Voices. My guest today is the executive director of SARA, that's the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, in Charlottesville, Virginia, Becky Waybright. Becky, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to do this.
I am so glad you were able to be on the show. You know, the news is full of, even this morning, Congress, my goodness, finally has agreed that in a few days it's going to have a vote on human trafficking. And then perhaps even we'll have another attorney general, who knows. But in the meantime, the rest of us in the regions, we are dealing with the realities every day of domestic violence, sexual assault. Not terribly long ago, I had the author of The Year After, Ashley Warner, on the show. She's spoken at University of Virginia regarding rape and sexual assault, bullying, domestic violence. Anyway, we know that on a daily basis, indeed, sadly, probably an hourly basis, you, Becky Waybright, and Sarah have to deal with this hotline and walk-ins and everything. Can you tell us what's the most challenging, as you see it on a daily basis, what's the most challenging issue for a victim, a target of sexual assault, before they even come to you, or when they come to you? What's that biggest hurdle for them to overcome?
I think a lot of it can depend on what the assault involves. You know, for some survivors, surviving the assault itself is a significant hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
Because there certainly are some situations where a rape is much more violent than others.
Yes.
So I think for some survivors, just getting through the first, you know, through the act itself is a big accomplishment. I think for others, you know, when you look at the situation where a survivor knows her assailant, maybe is out on a date with him or something like that, while there may not have been as much physical injury, there's typically a much stronger violation of trust.
Yes.
This is somebody they didn't expect to hurt them, and this person has. So the range of feelings can just be quite a number of different things, and it can really vary depending on what the assault was like. And sometimes it can really depend on what sort of coping style the person has ahead of time, in terms of, and support systems, what kind of resources they have that can help them recover from this trauma.
And when someone, and we know, of course, I like to mention this so people don't think it's a one-sided conversation. Men are also raped on occasion, but predominantly it is women who are sexually assaulted, as you say, either by a friend, a family, a neighbor, someone they know, generally a date, but sometimes by strangers as well. Give us the hotline, and then tell us, do some stop with the hotline? In other words, they don't come in, they just need someone to listen, to believe them?
Yes, and our hotline number is 434-977-7273, and it's available 24/7. So that's really important for folks to know about if they have any questions. Yeah, sometimes people do. They just call us with a phone call. They want to talk to somebody. They want to get information. They want to figure out what their options are, or they just want to know more. Like, let's say they want to know what will happen if I call the police.
Yes.
What sort of the steps from there. So the other thing that I've found that's pretty common with the sexual assault is that it may take some time before somebody's really willing to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they may make that hotline call to us now, and then they might not actually seek help for a year, 2 years down the road, something like that.
You know, this is something I think most men find difficult to understand, and it's why more men need to be a part of the conversation. But I've heard this from you, talking with you and with others before, that first of all, in the immediacy after such trauma as rape is, at the very least, physically and otherwise, one's memory is not always as clear on the facts. And of course, there's shame, and you always feel guilt, even though you didn't do anything. Is that first step giving the, you know, when they call you on the hotline, is that first step just making them feel they've called the right number?
Yeah, and a lot of what we do is validate what somebody's going through. It's funny, I mean, none of it's funny, but it always kind of amazes me how important it is when I tell somebody that it's not their fault. I think even when I've talked to children, you know, they'll feel like they did something to make it happen.
Mm.
So just those simple words telling somebody that it wasn't their fault really goes a long way. I think with adult survivors, there's always that feeling of somehow they did something to make it happen. With male survivors, you mentioned male survivors a little bit. I think with male survivors, they definitely feel like they should have been able to stop the assault. Typically when a male survivor is another man who's assaulted them, but they feel like they should have been able to fight off that person. And there really is a lot of shame and a lot of blame that comes with that. So a lot of what we do is just reassuring somebody, telling them they're not alone, telling them that we understand what they're going through.
And I know also from past conversations with you, one of the first things is assuring them that you believe them, that they are telling the truth, no matter how painful, because we've gone through, especially in Virginia, but all over the country, it's just that we've hit the headlines, you know, following so close on the crime of against Hannah Graham, third year student at the University of Virginia, and then so close upon that, Rolling Stone reporting a rape at a fraternity house that then was a story that was discredited. And unfortunately, I feel not only was the Rolling Stone story discredited, but in so doing, people have sort of allowed that lack of belief or trust in the honesty of the situation to spill over and stain the woman who is known as Jackie. And now even our chief of police in Charlottesville, Virginia, Tim Longo, has said that while what is written in Rolling Stone, he cannot find evidence of that. He's not closed the case because he is convinced that something indeed did happen to Jackie. So I guess all of that to say, how important is it and how do we support survivors when there is this public doubt raised?
Yeah, I think it makes it even more important to believe survivors. But people don't. And I think it's one crime where people are always looking for some role that the victim played in it that made it happen.
Yes.
If my house gets broken into, people are typically going to be sympathetic, supportive, you know, talk to me about what I might have lost.
Yes.
Or something like that, but they're not going to blame me for not having a security alarm system.
Yes.
But yet a survivor is typically going to have, people may say, well, you were drunk? Well, what, you know, maybe looking at things that, I think sometimes it's because it's such a horrendous crime, we don't want to talk about it.
Yes.
We want to somehow make it so that it doesn't happen to us. So
yes.
We try to find reasons. And all those things contribute to how the survivor feels and whether she feels supported afterwards.
So what can society do? I mean, as a people, as a community, we go to our government. Of course, obviously, the victims come to Sarah, that those who are fortunate enough to realize how beneficial that can be. But how does one prevent this? I mean, do we sit down? Are there enough? Let me put it this way. Are there enough, and repetition as well as enough, definitions, clarity when it comes to what sexual harassment is, what's domestic violence, what's bullying, what's rape? I know this probably, I hope, people are incredulous that I'm asking the question even, but I think there are, well, it's been claimed certainly by rapists that they didn't rape because XYZ was the case. But I know that's a huge umbrella I've thrown over you, but bullying, sexual harassment in the office, and you mentioned when you talk to children, without getting into any detail, but what are the youngest victims, how the age, I mean, that have been in touch with you that you've had to counsel?
Yeah, we've worked with kids as young as 4. It's more often in the 7 to 12 age range, and certainly our share of teenagers. Oftentimes it may be another child that has assaulted them, or it may be an adult. So the good thing about kids is that they're really resilient, and they respond well to what we're able to offer to them. The other thing that it's sad to serve children.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong, but a lot of studies will show that there are some adult survivors who have had who were also victims as a child. So when we serve kids, I look at not only are we helping them to survive that particular situation, but we are hopefully helping them to learn skills and to learn that they don't have to be a victim again, so that when they become an adult, hopefully they're less likely to be victimized again. So that's really kind of a prevention piece of our direct services that I think is really important, is to be able to work with kids and help them heal.
You know, when I asked that question, I guess I just wasn't ready for the answer. You know, it we know, or those of us who pay attention or believe, that rape and sexual assault and domestic violence and bullying, they're all really on the rise. They're increasing. It's an epidemic proportion in many places, including America. How do we educate the public to help prevent, but also the bully, the rapist? How do we make them... I go back to, are there clear definitions that one can point to, legally or otherwise, morally, in a society? Is there someone saying, look, when you do this, that's what it is? Because the justification for certain acts, and it just seems to me people are either conveniently trying to protect themselves, or they just don't get it. What do you run into, Becky?
Yeah, a little bit of all of the above, I would say. I mean, certainly there are legal definitions that will fit the different crimes, and will describe whatever charge somebody might be able to be charged with. I think sometimes it's really helpful to look at a continuum of violations. For example, the person who touches somebody when they don't want to be touched, you know, sort of on the low end of the continuum, and then if you look at the far end, being a rape or a sexual assault. And if we can kind of try to address the behaviors on the lower end, you know, if we talk with kids about, and I mean by kids, middle school, high school kids, if we talk to them about sexual harassment, if we talk to them about sexually inappropriate jokes, if we talk to them about what is consent and what isn't consent, then ideally we're giving them education that will help them be more healthy with their sexuality when they grow up, and that will also help them understand that if they hear their friend who's picking on somebody else or sexually harassing somebody else, that if they can call their friend out on that behavior,
yes,
maybe they can let their friend know that it's not okay.
Yes.
Maybe that person will then say, well, okay, I need to change my behavior, versus having that behavior, in a sense, condoned, where the person feels like they can continue to do it. So there really are a lot of ways to look at working with young people and kind of helping them identify how they might respond if they see things going on with their friends.
Are you, because we're talking more today than we have in the past, as best my recollection can tell, about minors as opposed to adult victims of rape, is that, is there some significance to that other than today we've sort of gone in that direction, or is there an increase in rapes under 18 years of age?
I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about the campus sexual violence, so I'm not sure whether that just draw me more to the younger people. But I think it sometimes is really hard. People don't always understand that we see children here, too. I think they're only thinking of the adult survivor when we see a great deal of kids. And it can be both heartbreaking, and then and it can also be really positive because we're able to do some great healing work with kids and really see some tremendous progress. And of course, every time we work with a child, we're typically working with family members too.
Sure. Oh well, I'm glad we touched on this more than perhaps we have in the past. And you're right. I mean, rape can happen anywhere. Military. Deployments as you say, on college campuses, University of Virginia grounds. As a person in the news and also married to a University of Virginia professor, I know that there things are being reported, and the university in particular is doing something to make it easier for rape victims to report online. So I think that's a step in the right direction. I know, well, I'm just going to say I think that's a step in the right direction. In any case, before we run out of time, Becky Waybright, who is the executive director of SARA, I wonder if you could give us a physical location, a website, and again, that hotline.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I live here sometimes.
Yes.
You know, our office is downtown. We don't typically give out the address, not because we don't. We're trying to hide it, but we really encourage people to call us rather than having walk-in appointments. So our office number is at 434-295-7273, and then our hotline number is at 434-977-7273.
Yes.
And then our website is at sarasteville.org.
Okay. All right. Let's just, if you don't mind, do all of that again, just a tad slower. Just so we
get, absolutely. Yeah. Happy to do that. Our office number, if people want to reach us about scheduling appointments or for any other information, is at 434-295-7273. Our hotline number, which is available 24/7, is at 434-977-7273. And then our website is at Sarah Seville, so it's SARAZVILLE.org.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. I hope you didn't mind the repetition. I'm sure you didn't. It's so important that people have this information. Any final thoughts before we have to go, especially concerning how the public can be more involved in preventing rape?
Yeah, I look at a couple things that I think are really important. One is it's absolutely important to support survivors. And the other thing when it comes to prevention is that we all have some part. You know,
yes.
We don't have to all be out there intervening in a rape situation, although hopefully if somebody sees that, they would call 911.
Yes.
But there can be a whole continuum, and starting with kids and giving them proper names for their body parts, teaching kids about boundaries and teaching people to value other people is really important.
And understanding that no is no, even if it's, as you say, just undesired attention or a touch, a hug when people are out having fun and having a drink, and they say, well, don't touch me. Well, it's don't touch me. But I think you raised many great points, but this last one, at the very least, if you see something going on that you know it should not be happening or is not desired attention, at the very least, if you can whip out your phone, you've said this to me before, and take a picture, why can't you whip out your phone and call 911 and get the authorities there?
Right.
Well, Becky Waybright, it is always informative, even though the subject is difficult, but it's always informative and a necessary education when we talk to you. I'm so glad you were on the show today, and I hope that people will contact you and make appointments as necessary. Families will find you supportive, as well as the individual who may have been targeted by unwanted violence of any kind, sexual assault, rape, etc. We're going to take a break, but don't go away. We're going to come back. Becky is leaving us for now, but we're going to talk to a co-worker of hers, the Crisis Service Coordinator, Taylor S. Starnes. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right. Thanks,
Marcello. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. On the surface, some films don't appear to have much of a story. We gain our satisfaction from characters on a journey, and slice-of-life films can soar simply by an artful observance of one encapsulated element of the human condition. Gloria tells the story of a middle-aged Chilean woman who finds herself essentially alone. She was married once, but her husband has broken through the fence. She has kids, but was strong enough to let them move on with their own lives. Now she faces the world bravely, seeking companionship and fun. She finds, however, that those interested in her are weighed down by the detritus of life. Gloria puts herself out there. She doesn't shy away from any adventure life may have to offer. She refuses to accept that her days of joy are over. They will not be. If there is pain in trying, so be it. We could observe her life and wince at the million hurts that life piles on and wonder, is there a point? But then we observe Gloria dancing, awkwardly, alone, giving wings to her spirit, caring little for the judgment of others, and suddenly we realize what we have here is a story of victory and a lesson for us all. Gloria. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. Our second guest this afternoon is the Crisis Service Coordinator of CERA. CERA, remember, is the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. The Crisis Service Coordinator is Taylor L. Starnes. Did I get all that correct, Taylor?
You did.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I don't think we've actually spoken before. I have to say, we've had a most educational conversation with the executive director, Becky Waybright, and we have chatted with her before. But from your position as the crisis service coordinator, first of all, tell us what that is, if you will.
Sure. So an aspect of CERA's support services to survivors is our crisis services program. And there are kind of two branches of that, one of which is our 24/7 confidential hotline, and then the other of which is our 24/7 emergency room advocacy response.
Mm-hmm.
So my position involves kind of supervising those two programs and doing outreach education and training in the community for allied professionals. I also train our hotline volunteers. So a couple different hats, but mostly relating to crisis response with sexual violence.
So it sadly it seems that you are kept quite busy at this. What are some of the numbers? Are there, I don't want to trivialize anything, but are there peak times of the day or even of the year where your job seems to be more demanding, the numbers more demanding, the victims more plentiful, if that's a way to put it?
Sure, you've heard with campus sexual assault and everything that's,
yes,
that's gone on lately. Certainly there are spikes around the beginning of the academic year. Sometimes we'll see a spike if there's a big event in the community or a holiday, that sort of thing. It's pretty unpredictable overall, but we do see spikes at certain times.
You know, even as I asked that question, it's not like I prepared it. It just sort of came out. But hearing your answer and the times that there are such peaks occur kind of is a bit telling. Is this as much a crime of opportunity as it is, the chance of someone very close to you that you trust but betraying you? How does that? I don't know. When you say the beginning of the school year, that sounds like somebody. I don't know. I don't know how to explain how I'm reacting to it, because I guess I just didn't expect your answer.
Right.
Yeah.
We refer to it as the red zone in the field, because that's the time when they're actually most likely to be sexually assaulted during their college experience. So the answer to whether or not it's a crime of opportunity, I think yes and no. I think that what people don't realize, and this is kind of gets to the myth in our society, is a lot of people think about sexual assault. Certainly I was raised to think about sexual assault as, you know, a stranger coming out of a dark alley.
Yes.
But that's not what we see. We see much more acquaintance sexual assault. So over 70% of sexual assaults are by an acquaintance.
As in a date or a fellow student, is that what?
Exactly. Someone that the person knows pretty well, or has met, you know, and gotten to know pretty well. So in that sense, I suppose those kinds of environments and atmospheres and large events can make for more opportunities for these predators to target people.
Okay, so let's, especially since you've mentioned the word predators, that's really something we have to realize. These people are predators. Anyone who forces themselves on male or female against their will in such physical violence in particular, but it is psychological as well and emotional. I guess we've sort of touched on this, but tell us about the stereotypes about sexual violence that we, and how it affects survivors, and how do we support the loved one?
So I think that the biggest stereotype is kind of what I was just speaking about.
Yes.
With this idea of us being taught to fear a stranger's attack, when
yes.
in reality it's more likely to be somebody that we know. And when you think about it, we're not only taught to fear that and taught to understand sexual assault in that way, but all of the things that we're told to do to prevent it from happening to us, right? Like
yes.
Home late at night alone and this, that, and the other. All of those things that we've been taught to do as prevention really only are preventative when applied to a stranger sexual assault situation,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Fewer than 5% of sexual assaults are by an absolute stranger. So I think that myth is very harmful. It's affected the way that we do prevention in our society, right?
Yes.
Kind of kept us in the risk reduction mindset for a very long time. And then we also see victims and survivors not identifying what has happened to them as sexual assault because it doesn't fit the picture that they've been given of what it looks like. Likewise, we'll see friends and family members be less likely to believe somebody when they describe an acquaintance sexual assault because it's not kind of what people understand. And obviously that plays into the legal system as well.
Yes.
Feeling like they're less likely to get justice.
I was just going to ask you that because of what you were saying, that when it's not a stranger, it's a lot more difficult to prove the point that, you know, it's a he said, she said in most cases. When it is a stranger, it's still just as traumatic, but there isn't the sense of betrayal. But at the same time, you can prove more easily, I don't know this person, therefore, if there is DNA evidence and I make this report, I'm more readily believed because I can prove I don't know this person. Whereas if it's a member of the family, someone I've been dating, someone I, you know, had a drink with in a bar, then I guess even the legal system, as you started to say, what do? They filter it through their own personal judgment? Is that fair?
Sure. And I'd say, so thinking about, you know, the common defense strategy
he's in any sexual assault case.
Yes.
If you're talking about an acquaintance or a relationship, you know, a previous relationship that a survivor might have with their perpetrator, anything along those lines really becomes about, all the defense attorney has to do is create some doubt.
Yes.
And the acquaintance situation gives them a lot more space to do that. And they can also start questioning the survivor's judgment, right, and bringing those issues up because they met this person, knew this person, trusted this person. So it can kind of open that door to the trial really being about kind of questioning the survivor and who they are and their lifestyle rather than just looking at whether or not the crime occurred.
And I think that's so important, this point you're making, is because the lifestyle thing. I mean, that's not just true on television. We see it in movies and television. They attack the character of the victim, because it's not the first time they've had sex or because of attire or whatever. But the reality is we need to become a society and a legal system that looks at the person as a predator who has done this thing. I mean, we're still innocent until proven guilty. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But is it a choice? It seems to me, as a layman to the law, that it has always been an attorney's choice to go after the victim's character. It's not like that's written into a law, but how does one challenge that? How do you say, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't be trying the case, defend your client, but based on something other than the woman once walked the streets or something, to use an extreme example? How do we get around that mindset of criminal justice?
It's a really interesting question. It's a fascinating question. And certainly there are measures such as what are called rape shield laws that attempt prevent those strategies from happening, but the reality is that they happen regardless and that there are exceptions to rape shield laws, and that's usually not too difficult for the defense attorneys to navigate kind of their way. I think that the question that it makes me wonder, because we don't ask those sorts of questions of other victims of crime, right? I've never heard about an alleged break-in being reported in the newspaper. If someone says someone broke into their house, we believe them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We don't question them. We don't ask what they did or didn't do, this, that, and the other. So what we do need to do is ask ourselves as a society, what is it about this crime, and what is it about these crime victims that we won't believe, that we refuse to believe? Because it really is a unique situation to this crime, that a person's judgment and character are so attacked, right? And
yes.
So integral in the system.
I think perhaps we haven't started a new conversation, but we certainly have hit on something that more people, particularly men, need to become a part of the conversation, this conversation. I've always said that. It's a point of how we balance justice for all with the crime of sexual violence when we're not used to doing that. I mean, clearly we're not. As you and Becky have said, someone breaks into your house, and you know, one can argue, I can hear in my head the devil's advocate saying, yes, but if somebody breaks in your house, you can tell that someone's broken into your house. You may not know who it is, so you have this instant proof. And in not all cases do we have instant proof of rape, because, as we all know, the stigma that comes with it, the condemnation that comes to the victim, even before you get to the courtroom, and the mental and psychological trauma, all of that sometimes delays the rape victim from picking up the telephone, say, and calling a hotline, etc., or going to the police. I know Becky has told me more than once that, which I don't know why it surprised me, but it did, that very often you get calls on the hotline before the police, so that you are the first contact. And I interpret that as being, I need help more than I need someone asking me to identify someone in a lineup or whatever. I don't know, maybe I'm getting off track, but how do we, I guess basically I'm saying, how do we as a society, because we have to do it first as the public before we can expect the legal system to adopt it, how do we show understanding and respect for the survivors, those who report and those who do not report, and also that category of those who report 6 months, 12 months, 18 months later, because finally they are able to talk about it out loud? I know that's a lot to throw, but you can answer them, I know.
I think is the most important thing is having compassion and understanding for someone's decision, regardless of what that is, right?
Yes.
So someone chooses not to call the police. They've probably thought about it, and they probably have a reason for not doing so. And if we can kind of garner some compassion for that situation, rather than, you know, using kind of the victim-blaming tactics of saying, oh, well, if you don't report, this will happen to someone else, and then you'll be responsible and that sort of thing. Having some compassion for that side of things, but then also just having more of an understanding of what actually does happen when somebody reports to the police, because I think there's an assumption that, you know, immediately someone will be arrested and then it will be taken to trial and this, that, and the other. And the fact is that actually very, very, very few of these cases are taken to trial. Very few of them even result in any kind of charges being pressed against the perpetrator. So our legal system has some really serious limitations when it comes to dealing with sexual violence. So this notion that it's on the victims and survivors to report, and it's on them to prevent this from happening again, is flawed ethically, right? Because it is victim blaming, but it's also flawed statistically, because statistically speaking, if someone does call the police and report, most likely no charges or investigation or trial will come of that.
Now,
so if we understand those aspects of the system, we can have some more compassion for people who make different reporting decisions.
Well, how do we, I guess this isn't new information, but just hearing you say it out loud makes me go, holy smoke, what are we still in the dark ages, for heaven's sake? How do we as the general public get the legal system? And again, just as they're not all police are out shooting people, there are good police, there are good attorneys, there's certainly good people with Sarah. How do we change that mindset? What do we have to do to make people realize that, let's say someone calls Sarah and has a conversation with Sarah, and that evolves into their thinking, I need to go to the police. There's a time limit on how long the rape kit is valid. Yes. Is that correct, first of all?
It is. So if someone would like to have a forensic exam, that needs to happen within 72 hours.
Okay.
Actually, my first piece of advice to anyone who's been sexually assaulted would be that they should go to the emergency room. In their area, because from the emergency room they can, you know, get that exam, kind of be presented with their options, and also involve the police if they choose to.
Exactly.
Do that. Certainly anyone in the area of Sarah, in the Charlottesville, Central Virginia area, who they would need to go to the UVA emergency room, which is the only one that can offer a forensic exam. And not only would the nurse who does those exams, who specializes in those exams, be paid to join them in the emergency room, but also one of our emergency room advocates would be paid to join them and make sure they understand their options, support them through the process, et cetera.
And one of their options, if I understand correctly, is, and that's great advice, by the way, go to the emergency room and then everything can evolve from there, but you're not forced to report it if for whatever reason you still would rather not make an official complaint, but you're on record with the authorities, with the hospital, with those who've examined you. You've had the tests that to make your case and support you as one who has been targeted. It's been prepared, in other words, should you decide at some later date to formally pursue prosecution. Did I make sense in that question?
That is correct. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think it's so important for people to know that if they do go to the hospital, the police will not be called immediately. It'll still be their decision. But medical care is such an important first step.
Yes.
And it is an option to have kind of that forensic exam done before you decide definitively whether or not to support, or whether or not to report to police. And that way that evidence can come back and support you if you would like to use it and move forward.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned the emergency room because I hadn't thought of that. It's just two great pieces of information to come together here at the end of our chat. I wonder, though, before we go, if you could just slowly again for listeners that give us that hotline for Sarah and website. How's that?
Absolutely. So our 24/7 hotline number is 434-977-7273. And our website is www.sarahcevile.org. So that's SARACVILLE.org.
And we've been talking to Taylor L. Starnes, who is the Crisis Service Coordinator for SARA, which is the Sexual Assault Resource Agency in Charlottesville, Virginia, doing tremendous work for those who suffer this kind of traumatic sexual violence. Is there anything before we go, Taylor, any other thing you just want to leave us with to make, I think the idea of calling, going to the emergency room is your first place, even though it's not required, but it's a great suggestion. Is there anything else you want to leave us with?
I think the most important thing that we can do as a community and as a public is to start by believing survivors when they come to us.
Yeah.
We know that an investigation will happen down the road, right, if there's a criminal proceeding. So if we just believe people and support them, that's the most important thing that we can do to help reduce the numbers of this sort of violence that we're seeing right now in our society.
And I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Taylor Starnes, for being with us today from SARA. We, of course, wish you and Becky Wavright and everyone at SARA all the best in what you do, because you certainly are one that stands up for the victim in this kind of, in what has become, I'm afraid, an epidemic of young children and young adults and older adults and from family members and relatives and acquaintances and dates as well as strangers. The first stop is getting the education and knowing what to do, and your suggestions have been most enlightening. I appreciate you being on the show today. Taylor Starnes, thank you so much for being on the show. Bye now.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. In the past, we have recommended following favorite directors as they are the artistic center of their films. But some actors have a keen eye for worthy material, the discipline to run from trash, and the skill to deliver when called. One such actor is Julianne Moore. She simply makes every project with which she associates better. Though not as well known as, say, Meryl Streep, she has the admiration of all those in the know and an Oscar for her work in Still Alice. Sifting through the almost 60 roles to date, let us share a few of our favorites. Would you like polished and hilarious? Try Crazy Stupid Love. Little known and extraordinarily ugly, Savage Grace. Subtle poignancy, a single man. Selfish parenting through the eyes of a child, What Maisie Knew. Good parenting within an atypical family, The Kids Are All Right. Or how about Paul Thomas Anderson's porn world masterpiece, Boogie Nights. Or the stylish and captivating time capsule from Todd Haynes, Far From Heaven. These selections are a great, though by far incomplete, representation of the work of Julianne Moore, one of today's finest actors, Meryl Streep of the indie world. The works of Julianne Moore, discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Bullying, race, religion, rape, and police. When I recapture the buoyant sculpturing of humanitarian dreams of grandeur, nothing as minuscule as Reagan's borrowed City of Light upon a hill, but rather a majestic, magical refuge, an international resort of equality for all under the sun, without daughters consigned under sons. There is America, the gem of the oceans, doctors and parents keeping the entire rainbow of children safe from the pot of gold greed of the money changers. But when I witness skewed visions of patriotism, or trivializing that which our mothers, grandmothers, and teachers filled our childhood, when I hear of California drought blamed on environmentalists, or loving God and country claims while hating Americans of different points of view, when governments overflowing with tax collectors fail peace but finance war while cutting taxes on bankers weighing down our future with student loans, I hope forward to when news media is immersed in investigative follow-the-money reporting devoid of repetitive, we don't know that yet, but we'll be right back after this indoctrination from corporatism owners of media truth to tell you again what we speculate about, what we just discovered has been going on since 1865, when the second phase of the Civil War began. And yet, I see through a glass darkly the light of our possibility. When big brothers include equal sisters on city councils, a social media embracing both friend and foe as close as tears and laughter, fusing left and right to center, yes, then I see us in wearing yellow for Seth, the face of both inventor and child recipient of 3D prosthetic hands, a black-looking president when he's not fast-tracking TPP, police officers caught on camera helping citizens in need, Alex's lemonade stand, the life of basketball player Lauryn Hill. You see, because we are involved with mankind, any disguise feigning freedom laws diminishes us just as a land of the free because of the brave cliché is no more patriotic than the Patriot Act. Bravery is not found in billionaire bombs blowing up the middle class for perpetual bottom-line battles. Courage is in the pursuit of ever-renewable renewables, like transferring our sweatshop dollars from ignorance to freeing higher education. Heroism is found more in a single creative artist than a Cheney corporate cover-up of human torture and environmental oil rig murders. America is exceptional to the extent it produces we the people like Deborah Sampson, Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul, Rosa Parks, Gloria Steinem, Alzheimer's Association Sue Friedman and Maria Shriver, Senator Elizabeth Warren, People Demanding Action Andrea Miller, Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, Andrea Douglas, ERA Eileen Davis, now Diana Egoscue, Lauryn Hill, and Maya Angelou. Because of them, we have decreased American lynching, shackles, and state-sponsored murder, but we have yet to overcome voter intimidation, private prisons, and the bullying of our children and rape of women by those unable to self-control the adrenaline of a little power is a dangerous thing. We are the America the greatest generation fought and died for when CEOs, CFOs, and directors on both Main and Wall Streets stand united in support of constitutional gender equality, affordable health care and education, a livable minimum wage, and All Lives Matter due process in addition to LGBTQ separation of church and state. For this is both the definition and challenge of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Like the 1991 LAPD News at 11 of Rodney King beating, we have video of a suspect on the ground, hands behind his back, handcuffed after being tasered, being beaten by a number of California police. What happens next is our answer to the pollster's question. Do you think the country is moving in the right direction? Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.